This is Black's Club in Dean Street in Soho, which I think is a pretty appropriate place to start a programme about the artist William Hogarth, because Soho's a lively centre for the graphic arts and for television and film, equivalents of Hogarth's working world. And there are still a few remnants of the low life, tarts and peep shows, for which it's always been famous. Hogarth knew these streets. The Painting Academy in St Martin's Lane, just round the corner, gave Hogarth, the East End boy, the young engraver, his first glimpse of high art. And in this 18th century house, recently made into a club, they've chosen to hang his prints on the walls. They are his two great suites of engravings, the Harlot's Progress down here in the basement, and the Rake's Progress very properly upstairs. Now, I don't know if that means you can lose a reputation or a fortune here, but it tells us something about how powerful Hogarth's images are today. And in this programme, I want to explore why, 300 years after his birth, Hogarth is still so appealing. And it occurs to me that the main reason is that he was so quintessentially urban.
The sense of him being the painter of London and of London life is probably one of the reasons why we're remembering him 300 years on.
The writer, Nick Dear, whose work includes a play about Hogarth.
He wasn't doing Dedham Vale and he wasn't doing ruins outside Florence. He was a Londoner. He didn't ever do the Grand Tour. He didn't see Italy or the ruins of Greece. Hogarth knew what we would now call the inner city extremely well. I think his achievement is comparable to that of Dickens in as much as neither of them are frightened to go down dingy alleyways, nor are they frightened to go into the grand salons of Piccadilly.
Hogarth the artist was shaped by his experience of early 18th century London, but he was a boy from the industrious merchant city rather than the fashionable West End. He was born and grew up near the Priory Church of St Bartholomew the Great, which had escaped the fire of London. From his front door, he could see the dome of St Paul's rising. I walked round this web of medieval streets with Hogarth biographer Jenny Uglow.
And then when you come out of that tangle of streets and the sort of warren of lanes, suddenly in front of you opens up what must have been in the 18th century a huge, teeming, open space. Suddenly there is Smithfield in front of you, full of men, women, animals, street sellers, carriages, noise, profusion, variety everywhere. It must have been an... We're very used to the sense that we walk through a city and there are always building sites, there are always cranes, there are always things being demolished, there are huge new skyrise buildings going up and everybody says it isn't the same, it's all changing. But the early 18th century was exactly the same. When Hogarth was growing up, the city was not just expanding, it was, as many people thought, it exploding.
London was already becoming the biggest city in the world. It had more animals in it than human beings.
The historian, Professor Roy Porter.
I think what Hogarth in particular does manage to capture is that sense that 18th century Londoners lived their lives out on the street. They ate in the street, they argued on the street, they worked out in the street, did their trade in the street, they picked up customers on the street if they were indeed street walkers. And Hogarth gets that feeling, and London was ablaze with life, and yet the fire was also something dangerous that was consuming.
Anyone want to buy a house?
Every day I would walk in the city of London in my lunch break and, retrace Hogarth's steps. I felt the city in those days of the mid-80s, when it was absolute boom time, was probably very comparable to the city that he'd known, with the South Sea bubble scandals and all kinds of business opportunities and crashes and what have you going on at that time. Anybody who was unscrupulous enough in the high years of Thatcherism had great opportunities to succeed. So the sense of a dog-eat-dog society seemed to chime in quite happily with what was going on in the 1720s and 1730s.
In this unforgiving mercantile city, there were winners and there were losers. For Hogarth's own father, a scholar who'd come down from Westmorland, things went badly wrong.
Hogarth's father ran a little school, and also ran, which seems very bizarre to us, a Latin-speaking coffee house. In other words, he was teaching those on the make how to speak Latin. Not surprisingly, it wasn't a great success. In fact, by the time Hogarth was 10, his father was deeply in debt, and none of his family could come to his rescue. So he was arrested for debt and sent to the Fleet Prison, which again is just on the southern side of Smithfields, all happening around this extraordinary diamond square in the middle. He was able to live at what are called the liberties of the Fleet, where you could take a lodging and your family could live there with you.
So as an impressionable young boy, he's actually living with his family in an open prison and observing the inmates.
Yes, certainly. Hogarth, more than any other 18th century artist, drew prisons and painted prisons, and even sometimes his stage sets or his aristocratic houses look like prisons.
Yes, he did have that fascination. He's fascinated with the Beggar's Opera and the character of Macheath in the Beggar's Opera, of which he did many different versions. He was fascinated by criminality and by punishment. He did draw an Irish murderess a few days before she was hanged.
Those are the prints that were for the really popular market, the famous murderess Sarah Malcolm, or the Jacobite rebel about to be hung, Lord Lovat, looking like a terrific old toad, which sold for sixpence.
So the popular market, the sixpenny prints, were sort of notorious people of the day, the Daily Mirror type people.
Yes, yes. But they show how much Hogarth is part of a world of a thriving print world. I mean, prints like those were being done all the time. He wasn't alone. He's not a lone genius. He just does what other printmakers are doing very, very much better. And he made popular graphic print culture into an art.
Every summer, London came alive with street fairs. Hogarth painted and engraved one of the most popular, which took place in front of the old church of St. George at Southwark. A mass of Londoners rushed between rival booths of actors advertising their productions. Jephthah's Rash Vow, Punch and Judy at Hellmouth, and The Siege of Troy, whose painted backcloth significantly obscures the church. You can hear the cacophony, drums, bagpipes, dogs, gamblers and drunks. These images of contemporary life, crowded with incident, were new in British art and became a hallmark of Hogarth's work.
I'm just trying to find them. 147.
Artist and satirist, Ralph Steadman.
Southwark Fair. There we are. Now, there's at least 100 people in here, if not more. That could well be a scene from a film. It's whatever the camera happens to encapsulate in that moment, just within its frame. What's outside is outside it. But in fact, we know now that things are outside that frame. What we happen to be looking at is just what the camera is pointing at. And there's something very matter-of-fact in the way he works. Whether the dogs were sneaking pieces of meat from somewhere or jumping up on the table and taking things away, they were elements of real life. And he was capturing them very definitively. So that, in fact, he did make people believe what they saw in his picture actually happened. There are no fading edges. It actually happens right up to the edge of the picture.
Here, Freeman, superb lady!
Although this print looks as though it captures one particular moment of life on the street in novelistic detail, that's not all that it is. When Hogarth shows us a stage collapsing, the actors upturned and showing us their underwear, he reminds us not only of the flimsiness of their show, but the wider precariousness which characterised 18th century society. Hogarth was an artist with a message to express, and he loaded these kind of works with emblem, verbal and visual puns, verses, warnings and announcements, and allegory borrowed and popularised from tradition. That's the paradox. Where we are offered realism in Hogarth's work, we are also given theatricality.
I have endeavoured to treat my subjects as a dramatic writer. My picture is my stage, and men and women my players, who by means of certain actions and gestures are to exhibit a dumb show.
Hogarth was fascinated by the theatre. He wrote in late life that shows of all sorts fascinated me when I was an infant.
Critic and broadcaster Andrew Graham Dixon.
The effect is very much of a theatrical show. There's always something rather artificial about the setting. The bric-a-brac with which he always fills his interiors has somehow the feel of stage property. It was as if the theatre became his metaphor for life itself. Not necessarily a positive metaphor either. I think the theatre for Hogarth represents what it is to be alive, because we are all deluded, we are all playing a part, we're all playing a role, we're trapped in an idea of what we would like to be, like the rake aping the aristocrat, or the harlot dreaming of being a lady of more noble breeding than she is. People are fooled by the roles that they invent for themselves. Henry Fielding, in the preface to Joseph Andrews, which greatly pleased Hogarth, said that some people have praised painters by saying that their characters seem to breathe, but in Hogarth, they seem to think. Now, in my opinion, in Hogarth, they look as if they're acting, people who think, people who breathe. If you think of the wife in Marriage à la Mode, in that scene of the morning after, where she is yawning nonchalantly and giving a little sideways glance to her husband as if he might be interested in her, or as if she's hoping that he might be interested in her. To me, that is exactly how an actress would perform that gesture. Or if you think of the rake at the end of The Rake's Progress, where he's sort of shaking his fist at the fates, there's something fantastically melodramatic about it. So that, for me, Hogarth the realist is Hogarth the portrait painter. And the progresses and the moralities are, for me, much more highly artificial, much more staged.
Hogarth himself tried on a variety of roles. He knew that the highest form of art was history painting, and at certain periods in his life he tried it with varying degrees of success. But the way we know him best is probably through the famous self-portrait with his pug dog. What's he telling us in this picture? It's a complex work. The dog sits on a foreground ledge along with an artist's palette. Behind these, resting on three books, is an oval canvas with Hogarth's head and shoulders on it. We can see that these books are by Shakespeare, Milton, and Swift. Hogarth aligns himself with the great English literary tradition, with authors who represent the tragedy and comedy of human life, the epic loss of paradise, and the bite of contemporary satire.
Hogarth in his portrait is looking very directly at us. Pug, who's a sort of very alive animal with glossy eyes and his tongue hanging out and his ears pricked, looked as if he's longing to be away. And it's as if Hogarth is saying, here I am the artist, I am the writer, I belong to this great tradition, but I'm also part of the real world, the sort of live animal world, and I understand nature as well as art.
The X-rays tell us that actually when it was started, Hogarth was presenting himself in a full wig and a rather grander coat. What do you think about the change that's come over this work?
If he had painted himself in his full wig and his dress, he would be proclaiming himself to be a gentleman, he'd say what his status is. Instead, he has the turban, which men of letters, the portrait of Pope, for example, wore at their ease in their studies, or gentlemen wore to smoke. He's got a very direct gaze, bags under the eyes, he's had a few nights out. He has a scar above one eye, and it was said he's very proud of this scar. He was quite proud of his battling spirit, and nobody knows quite how he got the scar. But it was said that he would always even push his hat back or his wig back so that the scar showed. So the move from the wig to this kind of portrait is typically Hogarth. It pushes him towards being a man of letters or learning in his study, but it also makes him a sort of bold and tough in a different way as well.
I was attracted to the energetic, rather laddish quality of him, and particularly from a dramatist's point of view, I thought, oh, here's a character we can have fun with. He doesn't take any shit from anybody. If there's an argument going, he'll be in it. He does have very particular views, and he's prepared to propound them very aggressively if he feels like it, which to a dramatist, of course, is a godsend.
In this scene from Nick Dear's play about Hogarth, The Art of Success, the painter is drunk at the Beefsteak Club and gets into his favourite argument, defending British, especially his own, art over the so-called masterworks imported from the continent by fashion-conscious connoisseurs.
Willie Hogarth, a great artist, let us assess his curriculum vitae. What cathedrals has he done? what frescoes and what battles.
My portraits are widely reputed.
Portraits, portraits. Any hack can do titchy portraits to clutter up sideboards. But a great artist. Let me remind you, one has toured the continent and one has seen great art. I mean the originals. Vast canvases in gold leaf frames. Huge blocks of stone chipped up to holiness. Annunciation, pietà. And in the damp palaces of Venice spent my inheritance, spent money like water, building my collection of Madonnas.
And dead Christ, holy families, flying angels, and shiploads, no doubt, of similar dark, dismal subjects.
Historical allegories, mainly, drawn from the well of antique myth.
Which no one can understand.
Not open to the common herd, I grant you.
Which I can't understand.
Lack of education is such a dreary thing.
I didn't have time for an education. I had to earn a crust, didn't I? I have no patron, no office, no inheritance, but I do have this body of work behind me built from nothing. It's not great, not quite, but not inconsiderable. I'll flog some shit. I know, but I do believe. I must allow myself to believe I got it in me. Great work, lasting work. I'm still learning, yeah. But I'm making a fucking go of it, aren't I?
There were times when he was extremely pugnacious and absolutely xenophobic. On a trip to Paris in 1748, he behaved obviously appallingly and said all the houses were gilt and beshit and, you know, and got sent home from Calais for being thought to be a spy.
Any change, please?
How did this energetic, pugnacious artist carve a place for himself? Well, he didn't do himself much harm by eloping with and marrying Jane, the daughter of Sir James Thornhill, sergeant painter to the king, who had decorated the dome of St. Paul's. It was from his father-in-law's studio at Great Piazza, right in the middle of Covent Garden, that Hogarth showed and sold his prints to an increasingly large audience, most of whom were middle class. His studio became known as the place where there'd always be something saucy on the walls. He painted two seduction scenes, before and after, which were unashamedly erotic. And with the development of a couple of sketches of Drury Lane prostitutes into the six images that make up The Harlot's Progress, gave his audience a new narrative form, the modern moral subject. The story of the harlot, the innocent country girl who is corrupted and eventually dies of syphilis, was tremendously popular.
I think Hogarth's morality is, on the face of it, very puritanical. And it has its origins in the 17th century. Paradise Lost and the Legacy of Original Sin, which are Milton's great themes, these are also Hogarth's great themes. That is the constant momentum of Hogarth's imagination, is everything always turns bad, everything always goes wrong. I think Daniel Defoe felt so sorry for the harlot in The Harlot's Progress that he decided to make everything better and rewrote her story as a novel, gave her a happy ending, allowed her to prosper, and called it Moll Flanders instead of Hogarth's Moll Hackabout. I think that even within the 18th century, other people took it upon themselves to somehow to redeem these poor creatures that Hogarth has condemned with this fantastic 17th century, almost Old Testament wrath, you know, thou shalt go to hell.
The questions one asks in looking at the progresses is how far are the harlot and the rake culpable? They both end up dead, but to what extent do they manage their own downfall? Is Hogarth blaming them or society in general? Certainly the people round the harlot are a recognisable and notorious bunch of corrupt London characters.
The board who exploits her, the Colonel Charteris, well-known topical figure, and a rapist, actually tried for rape in the same year that The Harlot's Progress comes out. The magistrate, again based on a well-known figure, Sir John Gonson, who went on harlot hunting raids, the jailer in Bridewell who beats her, who gets a horrible satisfaction out of it. It's these figures in authority, in power, who exploit others and who are linked, Hogarth suggests, to the government and the way that the government exploits them. Colonel Charteris, who is accused of rape in a heart-rending case at which there was a lot of evidence against him, is acquitted, to the horror of the populace, because he has influential friends, so it's said, and is indeed is a friend of Robert Walpole, the Prime Minister. And it's Hogarth, in a way, is speaking on behalf of those outraged people. So it's that kind of moral rather than the individual that he wants to push home.
The notion of social responsibility is very strong in Hogarth. And what you're seeing in paintings like The Rake's Progress is someone who's acting without social responsibility. I mean, the thing that people talk about and worry about most in the early 18th century is luxury. That's to say, the accumulation of wealth and goods. And is that compatible with, well, even sociability or, you know, getting on with other people, harmony?
Art historian Professor David Bindman. Hogarth makes it clear in the very first of the eight scenes of The Rake's Progress that Tom Rakewell's spendthrift ways are the inevitable outcome of another excess, his father's miserly obsession with money. In a modern way, Hogarth at least partly exonerates the rake by setting him in context.
The first painting shows the rake who's just come into his inheritance, and he's standing in what I think was meant to be a dark and gloomy, unfashionable room in the city of London. And the room reveals that his father was a pathetic miser. There are sort of signs of money hidden everywhere, and silver, and all sorts of signs of miserliness. The rake is being fitted for a suit, and at the same time he's dismissing his girlfriend, who's clearly pregnant, Sarah Young, her name is, and saying that I'm off to, more or less, to have a good time, or to go off to the West End is where he goes to. And then in the second painting, you've got what's called the levee, and this shows the rake now spending his money, and he's surrounded by, well, it's the title of the print is Artists and Professors, and you've got at the front a rather splendid French dancing master, you've got a landscape gardener, you've got a bodyguard, a fencing master, jockey, and on the far left, a musical composer who's composing an opera for him, and then in the back you've got a queue of other people all waiting to offer services.
The story of the rise and fall of a rich hedonistic young man is as old as the parable of the prodigal son. Every age has invented its own rake. George Cruikshank followed with the story of a dissolute drunk. For William Powell Frith, the vice was gambling. And in 1945, Sidney Gilliatt's film of The Rake's Progress had Rex Harrison as the wayward racing driver Kenway, a champagne-drinking playboy with a taste for chorus girls.
Kenway at Wimbledon. Kenway at Monte Carlo. Kenway at St. Moritz. Kenway at the Derby. Kenway broke. And finally, a much misunderstood man, Kenway, in jail.
And then in the fourth scene, you've got the rake rising in society, and he's just about to be presented at court. In fact, it shows him at the corner of Piccadilly and St. James. And at that precise moment, he gets arrested for debt.
The scenes that follow are that he marries a one-eyed hunchback old maid in unfashionable Marylebone, presumably for her money. Then we find him in a gaming house, followed by prison. The rake's progress through London, with events on the way like so many stations of the cross, is more than a literal journey. Every part of Hogarth's London carries a moral charge. The rake transgresses, moves from the darkness of the city to the false brilliance of the West End, crossing the moral abyss of Covent Garden with its playhouses and whorehouses in the middle. The final scene is set beyond the pale, outside the city, in the Bethlehem Hospital, known as the Bedlam Madhouse.
The almost naked figure of the rake, lying in a very dramatic and heroic pose on the floor, and he is manacled. Sarah Young is lamenting over him, and it's often been pointed out this is a little bit like a Mary Magdalene weeping over Christ. And then around it you've got this mad scene of all the well, the lunatics in the asylum, but with one or two spectators
Something that would have surprised us nowadays about Bethlehem was that there was open public visiting. It was absolutely on display to the public. It was a bit like a human zoo. You see, for example, a mad king sitting on a close stool with a fake sceptre and orb. You see a mad astronomer with a bit of rolled up paper looking up at the ceiling. You see a mad papist praying with his rosary. Now, these are all the cardboard images of mad people that you would have had in 18th century England. He's a pretend king, and this is the age of the pretenders. And therefore, there's a kind of joke built into every image that Hogarth offers of a mad person. So we're not really seeing clinical madness here. We're seeing madness as an emblem of a civilization gone mad. And the proof of this is the figure right at the very back, the mad artist. Hogarth has, as it were, inserted himself into the image. And in some of the prints, in some of the engravings of this, what you see is that the artist is drawing a kind of golden sovereign of a coin of the realm. And written on it is Britannia. So, in fact, this isn't Bethlehem, after all. This is Britain that he is actually showing.
Professor Roy Porter. When David Hockney etched his version of the Rake's Progress, he didn't set it in London, but New York, and he cast himself, the innocent abroad, as the rake. New York is the new mad world where he sees things he hasn't seen before. But at least Rakewell doesn't die in the final frame. Hockney returned to the rake, designing marvellous stage sets for Stravinsky's opera, with a libretto by Auden and Chester Kallman that was produced at Glyndebourne in 1975. Hockney describes how Hogarth's prints influenced the making of those sets.
Instead of looking at Hogarth's paintings, I looked at the engravings. And as you know, there's a technique in engraving. If you're only using line to achieve half tones, you use what's called cross-hatching, which is different thicknesses of line going different ways. And the intention is that when you move away, the lines become greys, different greys. And you can, the whole range, the tonal range is very, very big. Then to start the model, because it's all made, most of it was made as a three-dimensional model. I listened to the music all the time I was doing it. And at night, I'd sit in the room and set each scene up, and I'd cut out these little figures with, I'd stuck real faces I got from the TV guide or something, and then I'd play the music for the scene. The amazing thing is, it's exactly like my little model.
Despite the popularity of his modern moral subjects, Hogarth wanted to prove himself as a history painter and to make the move more completely from craftsman engraver to gentleman artist. But would connoisseurs and aristocratic customers be interested in the work of an artist known as a maker of prints that were both satirical and, far from being an exclusive product, came rolling off the presses by the thousand? An answer of a sort came when Hogarth became a governor of this place and helped turn it into the first public art gallery in the country. It's the Coram Foundation, formerly the Foundling Hospital, in Brunswick Square in Bloomsbury, and it still answers a need in ministering to troubled children and their families.
The Hogarthian world, in terms of need, has most certainly not gone away. I think it's one could argue that some of the needs are little changed, and the consequences of poverty are certainly with us. Possibly some of the other needs we deal are old needs with new labels.
Deputy Director of the Coram Foundation, Richard Wider.
Standing where we are at the moment, we are in fact looking at what was the site of the Foundling Hospital. The hospital stood on the artificial playing field, which you see in front of us. The main thing that is actually left of the old Foundling Hospital is the colonnade, which we can see beyond the playing field, which was formed for what I suppose must have been a fairly grand entrance to the hospital. And it was through that entrance that the visitors would have come in the early days, and we know that it was a place where people came to be seen. They came because of the chapel where Handel was giving his concerts. It was a fashionable place to come on Sundays. They seem also to have come, frankly, rather to gawp at the Foundling children as they consumed their Sunday lunch.
The Foundation's headquarters incorporates part of the original building, including the grand staircase and the courtroom, the decoration of which was organised by Hogarth. And it's in this part of the building that the pictures that were donated by Hogarth, Highmore, Heyman, James Wills, and a sculpture given by Rees Brack are displayed. Rian Harris, curator of the collection, showed me round.
It was established in 1739 by Thomas Coram, who was a shipwright and sea captain. He spent 17 years campaigning to actually establish the hospital.
What is a foundling?
A foundling is a deserted or abandoned child. In this case, because of the 18th century attitudes towards illegitimacy, we can assume it was probably an illegitimate child. But it is not an orphan. It is a child that was abandoned. In fact, babies were found on dung heaps. They littered the streets. Many young women of the time had no alternative but to abandon their children on the streets of London.
The great painting by Hogarth in the Foundling Hospital is his glorious portrait of Thomas Coram. And it appears that Hogarth gave the portrait to the hospital, firstly, I suppose, in honour of its founder, but secondly, in order to exhibit it and for people to see it.
The portrait which I painted with most pleasure, and in which I particularly wish to excel, was that of Captain Coram for the Foundling Hospital. And if I am so wretched an artist as my enemies assert, it is somewhat strange that this should stand the test of 20 years' competition and be generally thought the best portrait in the place, notwithstanding the first painters in the kingdom exerted all their talents to vie with it.
There's something ambiguous about the philanthropic activities of people like Hogarth, and it was an ambiguity that was known at the time. On the one hand, this was Christianity in action. A good Protestant doesn't merely profess his faith, but he does it as well. Therefore, he gives money, gives time, becomes involved in saving the poor and things like that. And yet, God also helps those people who help themselves. And there was this sense that conspicuous philanthropy was also a way of getting on. Hogarth, as a painter, loved the opportunity of actually displaying his own paintings at the Coram Foundation, just as Handel, as a composer, liked having his oratorials performed there. You could look ahead from Hogarth and think to maybe the Sainsburys and the Saatches and people like that nowadays, and see the same sorts of ambiguity about philanthropy as being both a way of doing good and doing well for yourself, and, as it were, making sure your name has a kind of public prominence.
We're standing in front of Hogarth's large portrait of Captain Coram, and there's no doubt that Hogarth was a grand painter. He has said in his autobiographical notes that he wanted this to be a mighty portrait, and it definitely is that. It's a marvellous portrait because it's a mix of both grandeur and a slight sense of informality. Coram's set up two steps. He looks rather a small man perched on a chair, and he's set in front of a classical column behind which you can see a seascape. We know that Hogarth was one of the founders of the Beef Steak Club, and I do associate in my mind Hogarth with beef and beer, and I get a slight whiff of beef and beer when I look at this painting.
Captain Coram looks, when you walk into the room and you see it, you see this billowing drapery and this rather heroic pose, very reminiscent of Van Dyck. It could almost be after the Great Peace, huge portrait of Charles I, seated, again, with this rather heroic seascape behind him. But then when you look at it more closely, you realise that Hogarth has inhabited that convention of Baroque portraiture only to reveal his difference, because the billowing drapery turns out to be a coarse old sea coat that's been hardened by salt air. There's a ruddy flush to Captain Coram's cheeks. So, in a sense, what Hogarth's done, he mimicked a portrait of a king or a courtier, placed a middle-class gentleman in the frame, as it were, and then adapted his own art accordingly. So the portrait is a kind of criticism of other art, as well as being its own art.
Andrew Graham Dixon. Hogarth was not only the leading portrait painter in the first half of the 18th century, he was an exceptional talent, refusing either to flatter or sentimentalise his sitters. He gave us instead individuals and group portraits of adults and children that seem ready to move and speak.
You no longer get that sort of school assembly portrait line of heads, because he twists the figures round, he turns them in space, they're interacting with each other, and then suddenly you'll notice that there's a cat in the background, and the cat is trying to catch the bird in the cage, and the little boy is playing music, and he thinks that the bird, which is twittering like crazy to get away from the cat, is actually twittering along with his music, and so he's laughing. But he's wrong to be laughing because he doesn't understand what's going on. And suddenly you realise that what was just a portrait has actually turned into something much more vivid and strange, and a picture that contains these elements of intense liveliness, but also a slightly sinister tone, a note that death has entered this childish paradise.
The portraits of Max Wall by the artist Maggie Hambling enjoy the same subversive energy.
Well, I suppose the painting of Max in the studio with a large white barn owl flying in through the window could be put in the same category.
Maggie Hambling painted from memory a series of drinkers in pubs without ever making a sketch of them at the time. Hogarth had a similar skill. He devised a mnemonic technique, a kind of linear shorthand, reducing a figure to two or three lines, which he could then flesh out in his studio.
I would just have half a bitter, which I would make last a very long while, and then shut my eyes, turn away from the subject, and sort of check that I'd got that eyebrow, or check that I'd got that nostril inside me. So I trained the visual memory, and so after about an hour, I could return to the studio and make the painting entirely from that information. I didn't draw at all. I just looked and looked and came back and did it from memory.
Hogarth painted a lot of rumbustious, beefy men that really jump off the canvas, and you're showing me a picture of George Arnold. Why do you like George Arnold?
Well, I'd certainly say that George Arnold has a lot going on in a very busy brain behind those eyes. The weight and the presence of the man is there in all its sort of sweat, and you feel that he's breathing, and I don't know what more you can ask from a portrait other than it's there in front of you and you have this visual conversation with this person that seems to be completely alive. I mean, part of the life force of his work is that each tiny figure in Marriage à la Mode or wherever it is, each one of those is a portrait of that person, even if it's a portrait of someone from his imagination. And so, you know, his work is full of portraits, and it seems that, which is extraordinary to me, people have great difficulty with portraits. And, I mean, when you say the word Rembrandt, what comes to mind, I should have thought immediately to most people, were the portraits and the self-portraits. And so somehow it's okay for Rembrandt.
Hogarth was a good businessman and earned himself enough money to buy this little country house at Chiswick. But he became a slightly isolated figure. Although he never stopped pouring scorn on the British connoisseurs for their mindless admiration of the old masters, he continued to harbour a desire to challenge the great painters. Towards the end of his life, when he was losing the prominent position he'd held in the London art world, he painted an imaginative portrait of Sigismunda, a princess who falls in love and marries Giscardo, one of her father's attendants. Enraged by the unequal match, the king has him killed, and we see the tragic and tearful Sigismunda clutching her dead husband's heart in a goblet, which also contains the fatal poison which she will drink.
My object was dramatic, and my aim to draw tears from the spectator. As £400, a short time before, had been bid for a picture of Sigismunda by a French master, but falsely ascribed to Correggio, £400 was the price at which I rated this.
Well, the problem seems to be that people didn't like it when it hung in the Society of Arts exhibition of 1761, if I guess it would have been. There are various stories about it. One was that he hired a man to sit under the picture and listen to comments and write them down. The result was that he withdrew the picture.
Hogarth scholar Professor Ronald Paulson. Sigismunda was universally ridiculed and refused by the patron who commissioned it. It's probable the picture was Hogarth's attempt at the sublime, an idea gaining ground in European thought and promoted in Britain by Edmund Burke.
I think he made the experiment with Sigismunda, realized that it was a failure, and revert it, because the last prints are definitely anti-Burke, anti-sublime, and they would certainly say the sublime is lugubrious and destructive and about pain and ultimately about death.
After Sigismunda, Hogarth virtually gave up painting, concentrating his energies on a group of forceful prints, including Beer Street, Gin Lane, and The Four Stages of Cruelty. Hogarth made the cruelty prints as a protest against what he saw as the barbarous treatment of animals on the London streets. The cycle of cruelty begins with a boy tormenting a trusting dog, tying a bone to its tail.
The cruelty toward the dog has led to his robbing a house where his girlfriend works and killing the girlfriend in the process. But what Hogarth has done is, number one, produce quite a monumental composition. Number two, the composition evokes the traditional scenes of Christ being taken in the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, you know, you start thinking what that means. And then you look at the last plate where the criminal has been hanged and is being dissected. And you look at the monumental forms, which Hogarth actually made more monumental by hiring a wood engraver to make large wood engravings of the two of them. You get some idea of where I think serious history painting for Hogarth goes most successfully.
Towards the end of his life, I think that there's a great deal of bitterness and despair in his later years. But when his morality becomes a kind of nihilism, when it's as if he doesn't believe in anything, he doesn't believe in himself, everything is sick and rotten, it begins to go crazy and take satire into a whole different realm of almost surreal inventiveness and produce images like the very last image, the bathos. In a sense, it is the last plate in his own progress. The figure of Father Time lies prone in this desolate landscape where everything is broken. The church bell is cracked, the artist's palette is cracked, the bow is unstrung, the buildings are ruined. The figure of Time just breathes out this last gasp of a cartoon-bubbled word, finis, the end. And there's something astonishingly dark about it. So dark and so strange and so weird that it's as if he's come adrift from all the morality of the work that we associate with him and begun to invent something else.
Hogarth died in Leicester Fields in 1764 and was buried in Chiswick. I think we'll remember him not only for what he made, but for the battles he fought. It's been said of him that he showed, and not to English artists only, both a new social role and a new loneliness. His lessons were learned in the Romantic age.
His determination to forge a career as an independent creative force lies behind the truculence and determination of Constable, or indeed of Turner. Again, artists who weren't particularly influenced by him at the level of technique or style, but at the level of this determination to be your own man.
Nobody had ever shown us properly the world of the London poor, the criminal classes, the prostitute classes, and Hogarth's great achievement, in my opinion, was he made that a legitimate subject matter for very highly capable art.
He remembered that particular look of somebody being sly, someone full of caprice, somebody cheating somebody else. That's where the greatness really lies, is catching that moment of transition between a good thought and a bad thought.
I, like many people, grew up with a Hogarth print somewhere at the top of the stairs, which I dimly remember, and remember sort of passing and repassing through my childhood in the way that one also passed and repassed characters from Dickens. And you know, Hogarth's achievement was, as he set out to do, was to get a picture into every home. That's why we're still interested in him.
The Modern Moralist was presented by Dr. Judy Collins and produced by Susan Marling.